This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with the Irish actor Chris O'Dowd. He was introduced to a large American audience through the film Bridesmaids, in which he played the police officer with a crush on Kristen Wiig's character. O'Dowd's also known for his role in the HBO series Girls as the finance guy who's briefly married to Jessa. He's been in several British TV series, including The IT Crowd. O'Dowd created and co-stars in the comedy series Moon Boy, which is shot in his hometown in Ireland and is based on his memories of growing up there. Now O'Dowd is on Broadway, starring in the revival of the theatrical adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, a performance that's earned O'Dowd a Tony nomination. Of Mice and Men is about two migrant farm workers in California during the Great Depression. Lenny, played by O'Dowd, is big and strong but mentally slow. George, played by James Franco, does the thinking for the duo. Terry began her interview with O'Dowd with this recording of a scene from Of Mice and Men, in which Franco's character George speaks first.
With us, it ain't like that. We got a future. We got someone to talk to who gives a damn about us. We don't got to sit in no bar room blowing in our jack just because we ain't got no place else to go. If them other guys gets in jail, they can rot for all anyone gives a damn.
But not us. And why? Because I got you to look after me and you got me to look after you, and that's why.
Chris O'Dowd, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you get the part in Of Mice and Men?
Well, I just got a call about it, you know. It was one of those where I got a call to ask whether it would be something I would be interested in. I jumped at it, and then it went away, and I presume that they went back to their first choice, as is often the case. And then, thankfully, that fell apart, and I came back on the horizon and jumped at it again.
So what's the place of John Steinbeck in the literary curriculum in Ireland?
The first book that we wrote, that we read in high school, as it were, was The Pearl, when we were maybe 13. And then when we were 15 or 16, we did Of Mice and Men. So there definitely is some correlation between... My feeling on it is that Steinbeck's work seems to be so much about chasing the American dream. And so many Irish people have chased the American dream. You know, I'm an economic migrant myself, and I can definitely relate to it in that way.
Did you like Of Mice and Men when you read it in high school?
I don't know necessarily if I took as much notice of... You know the way that sometimes when there's a book that is prescribed, I don't know if I would say that it was my... I don't think I liked any books in school. I think I liked girls in school. I think... I'm not sure I liked... I think I liked making people laugh in school. I don't think I came to literature until much later on.
You have a series that's on television in Ireland and in England as well?
Yes, it's on Sky TV in England.
Right, and here in the United States, it's available on Hulu, on the internet. And it's a semi-autobiographical series about a 12-year-old boy growing up in the town where you grew up in Ireland. Describe the character of Martin.
Well, he's an idiot. I mean, if I'm honest, what I like about our show is that I find that... kids on television are often precocious, and they always seem to be teaching the parents something by the end of the episode. And that is not my experience of kids. Most kids I know are dumb. And my nieces and nephews have never taught me anything other than how to find my keys when they've hidden them somewhere. So it's a very semi-autobiographical show. The kid is really me growing up. It's in my hometown. We shoot some of it in my mum's house. And he has an imaginary friend who I play in the show.
So I want to play a clip from the first episode of Moon Boy. And so, you know, the bullies have been, like, picking on him. And then, you know, the 12-year-old Martin gets a gift from his parents. And it's the gift he's most wanted. It's a brand new bicycle. And the first time he takes it out... The bullies find him, and they absolutely destroy the bike. And Martin goes home. He doesn't really want to tell his parents what happened because he's so embarrassed, but his parents figure it out. And his father decides to go to the bully's home and have a talk with the bully's father. The bullies are brothers. In case he needs a weapon, he puts a hammer in his pocket. And the father, you know, Martin's father is a kind of, you know, mild-mannered, get-along kind of guy. But mm-hmm. but he's got the hammer in his pocket, and he goes to the bully's house, rings the bell, and the father comes out, and here's the father speaking first.
Hello there.
Are you Mr. Bonner?
Jerry Bonner, yes indeed.
Right. Well, my name is Liam Moon.
Hello, Lee Moon.
Hello. Now listen. My son goes to school with your boys, and they...
Oh, no, they're awful, aren't they?
Sorry?
I mean, I love them, of course I do, but they're awful. Let me guess now, you come over here today because Connor and Johnner have done something rotten to your boy, am I right?
They broke his new bicycle.
Oh, they're awful bullies. I'm so sorry. Is he okay?
Yeah, well, he's a bit shaken up, yeah.
Of course he is, the poor lad. I don't know what to do with him anymore. I mean, you probably come over here now expecting me to be some horrible, angry brute who bullies his kids, who in turn go out and bully other kids. Am I right?
Well, kind of, yeah.
Well, I'm not. I'm a good person.
You seem like a good person.
Thank you. You seem like a good person, too.
Thank you.
God, I hate my kids.
I'm not too crazy about my own.
They're awful, aren't they, children? I mean, here we are, two decent fellas full of compassion and willingness to love. And what do we get in return?
Hassan.
You know. Listen, there's nobody in at the minute. Do you want to come in for a quick cup of tea?
Well, I don't know.
You're the look of a man who wants a cup of tea now. Huh?
All right, then.
Good man. Is that a hammer in your pocket? Let me guess. You were planning to beat me to death with it, weren't you?
I was indeed.
Bloody kid.
Ah!
Did I say tea? I meant gin.
And that's Unchained Melody playing in the background, which is funny, like they're falling in love.
Whenever we're in the edit for the show, the producer is always pulling his hair out because I'm always asking for panpipe versions of songs. The oddest one that we've got in the newest series, we do a panpipe version of the Mission Impossible theme.
So I really like the father in this. And so much of the contemporary Irish literature that comes to the U.S. has this like abusive or alcoholic mm-hmm. or totally absent father. And the fathers in your show, they're like, they're responsible. They're intimidated by their own children. Who is the father? Who is Martin's father based on in this? Was your father like that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he's very sensitive. He actually came to see Of Mice and Men the other night. And they flew over from Ireland. And the tears, I mean, he's a very sensitive soul. And most of the men that I do know are very sensitive. And I do like exploiting that for humor. Essentially what happens after that scene is they join a group of men called Men's Anonymous, which is essentially just men who hate their kids. And they all get together once a week and pretend to play poker, even though none of them know how to play poker. And try and do some kind of new agey talk. It's like, be dad, not sad.
How popular is Moon Boy in Ireland and England?
It's pretty big. In Ireland, it's on a cable channel, and it was the most watched show in 5 years on that channel, which is
wow.
So that's great, and we've been kind of winning a few awards here and there. So it's terrific. So we've shot a second. There's a second series just starting on Hulu. And I've shot a third one. Which
when
I'm
you say
in
series, you mean in American parlance, season.
Exactly. Yes, a season. And also it's only like 6 episodes each season.
Yes, I've noticed that seasons keep getting shorter and shorter. It's soon going to be like it's 1 episode per season.
Well, the British model and the Irish model has always been 6. So,
really?
Yeah. So even going back to Monty Python and things like that, and Fawlty Towers was 6 a season. And The Office and all of those shows. They're always 6 a season.
Yeah. So, and how did you end up on Hulu in the U.S.?
I think we're also on PBS, which I should probably
say. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I think we just sold the distribution at some stage along the way. That's above my pay grade.
Right. Okay. When are you on public TV?
I'm not sure. I think it changes.
Then how
from
am I supposed
check
to
your
know?
Listings.
You don't know.
Well, I don't, I'll check your listings, everybody.
Okay.
Is that what you say here?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes.
So one of the economic centers of the town that you grew up in was a call center, which I believe you worked at for a while before becoming an actor.
Yeah, that's not quite right. I worked at a call center for sure, but that was when I was living in London.
Oh, okay.
But I worked at a call center for different charities. So essentially, we would be calling up people who had subscriptions to whichever charity and asking them to increase it. And I, this is pretty terrible, but I worked for a very famous wildlife charity for quite a while, and we would call up people and tell them that different species were being eliminated and becoming extinct, and we were trying to raise funds to protect them from that. But very often these species would be like bats and like newts. And I would call up and I'd say, oh, this bat in Papua New Guinea is going to become extinct. And the person on the other end of the phone would be like, great, that sounds like a pain. I'm delighted. You want some extra bullets? Is that what we're paying for? No. This newt in, you know, New Zealand. Oh, good, good. Who wants newts? So eventually, to get any money, oh, this is bad. I would start, I would make up endangered species. So that seemed more palatable.
Oh, what's some of the names that you'd make up?
Well, the one that was most successful is I told people for maybe 2 months up and down England that the tiger swan was in danger. The tiger swan was essentially a swan with the markings of a Bengal. You can visualize that in your head. And I would tell people this. And they would say, I've just never heard of it. And I'd be like, well, it's endangered. You know, if it was common, I wouldn't be calling. So yeah, there was the tiger swan. There was some kind of a flying dolphin or something, but like
oh,
a flying salmon. It was not like actually in the air, but like, it was poor behavior. But we made quite a lot of money. So a lot of newts were saved.
I'm going to ask you about the movie that made you famous in the United States, and that's Bridesmaids, your breakthrough role here in the U.S. And this is a Judd Apatow-produced film. Why don't we start with a scene? Because people who've seen the movie will certainly remember this scene. So Kristen Wiig plays Annie, the bride's best friend and maid of honor, but the wedding's creating a lot of friction between them. And the Kristen Wiig character, Annie, has started to go out with your character, a police officer named Officer Rhodes, and they met after he pulled her over because her taillights were out, and he agreed to tear up the ticket if she agreed to get the lights fixed, which she didn't do. And then they spend the night together, but after that, she kind of freaks out and rejects him, so he's very hurt. And in this scene, Annie's just had a huge fight with her friend at the friend's bridal shower, and while driving home, she totals her car, she needs a tow truck, and you come by in your official capacity as a cop. And as you're talking a little later in the scene, John Hamm drives up in a sports car to pick her up. So you speak first in this scene.
Do you have any idea how frustrating it is to see you night by night drive past me with your taillight still broken? Do you have any idea how crazy that makes me? It's a simple solution. Your problem, Annie, is that you just don't understand that you can hurt people with these broken lights. Don't you see how irresponsible this is?
Yes, I should have gotten my taillights fixed, but I didn't, okay? I didn't.
Listen, don't worry about it. Seriously, your message was received.
No, look, please, I don't know what's going on with me right now.
Look, it's fine, don't bother. No. Really, it's, what's done is done.
Wait, that's it? Where are you going?
That's it. That's how this works.
Well, come on, I didn't.
For the record, Annie, you flirted with me. You made me feel like you really liked me, which was really unfair. And then you came home with me and we did stuff, fun stuff, and then you just left. It's like it was nothing.
Oh, please. I know how guys do this thing. I know how guys act. One minute it means something, the next minute it doesn't.
Oh, right, yeah, you've got it all figured out.
Yeah.
How's that working out for you? Pretty good?
What's up, buddy? Call for some roadside assistance? Thanks, officer. I can handle it from here on out.
Come on!
And that's John Hamm driving up at the end of that scene. So you're such a really sympathetic character in this film. How did you get the part?
I auditioned. I went in. Paul Feig, the director, had known some of my stuff. I did a sitcom in Britain called The IT Crowd, and he had been a fan of that. So I got in to the room, and I improvised with Kristen for maybe 45 minutes. And we just had a really good time. And I kind of went in, not necessarily, I didn't have a name or anything like that. And it was going to be a very hard get. So I didn't go in with much expectation. I just really enjoyed myself. And thankfully it all worked out all right.
Let's talk about your role in Girls. And this was in the first season. And you played a finance guy named Thomas John, one of the few guys who made a fortune on the recession. And you meet Jessa and Marnie at a club. You buy them a drink and then invite them home. And your character is really excited at the prospect of a three-way. That's what he's really hoping for, which is what Jessa and Marnie kind of lead him to believe is going to happen, because they start kissing each other, but they won't let him kiss them. And as he grows more frustrated, Marnie knocks over a drink on his very expensive rug, and then he just kind of blows up in frustration. Here you are.
Do you even know what it's like to work hard?
No, Talos.
I've been under a lot of pressure. My whole life. To succeed. Daddy didn't buy me this rug, or this apartment, or this nose. That's not your nose. There's no way that's your nose. There's no cartilage in the world that exquisite. So it kind of ticks me off when I come to Williamsburg after working hard all day in the real world. And I see all these stupid little daddy's girls with their bowler hats. What are you doing with bowler hats, stupid? And then you come over and you flirt and flirt and flirt and flirt and kiss and kiss. And listen to my amazing tunes, drink my beautiful wine, and then spill it all over my gorgeous rug and laugh about it.
Yeah, well, we're not laughing at your rug, trust
me. Laughing. You don't hurt us.
We're laughing at your mashins.
Mashups!
It's my guest, Chris O'Dowd, in an episode of Girls. And you end up marrying Jessa. You end up being a really pretty sympathetic character, because at first you seem like a real jerk, but you're kind of insecure. You want to love and be loved. And yeah, like I say, ended up being more likable than you initially seemed to be.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those... I was surprised to get asked back. I had met Lena, and she asked me to come and do an episode. And
Lena Dunham, the creator.
Sorry,
of Girls.
Lena Dunham, who makes the show. And so I went and did that, which is that kind of the episode where that scene that you just heard. And I presumed that would be that. And then she asked me to come back, and I was kind of reluctant, because I was like, what else can you do with that character, really? He's just such a douche. And she's like, oh, I want him to marry one of the girls. I thought she was joking, if I'm honest. But I think she was right. They had to probably make him a bit more sympathetic, because otherwise it's just he's just a guy ranting for, you know, three or four episodes.
So there's another scene that I want to play, and this is from This Is 40. And just in case it's not clear, Bridesmaids was produced by Judd Apatow. Girls is produced by Judd Apatow. And This Is 40 was produced and directed and written by by Judd Apatow.
I owe
Apatow.
That guy a drink.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah.
So in This Is 40, Paul Rudd is the star, and he plays a character who's has this like fledgling indie record label, which is specializing in retro rock. And in order to stay in business, he needs an album that's actually going to sell some copies. And so he's invested all of his hopes and his money in an album intended to revive rocker Graham Parker's career. And you're skeptical that anyone is going to be interested. And Lena Dunham also plays someone who works at the company, and she's handling some of the publicity for the album. And she's just produced a promotional video which features archival footage of Graham Parker along with current footage and current interviews. And you do not like this video. You speak first.
What are you doing?
I'm contextualizing him as one of the great figures in rock history.
You can show him in his prime in 77 and then jump straight to him as he is now. It's terrifying. You gotta reverse it. You gotta show him as he is now very briefly and then show him in 1977. You gotta Benjamin Button it.
I know what you're talking about, okay? All rock stars are older now. Steven Tyler, David Bowie, Mick Jagger.
Paul McCartney.
Okay, stop it. Everybody that you are mentioning looks like an old woman now. You're just mentioning a bunch of Jessica Tandys. Keith Richards gets away with it. But that's because Keith Richards looked 70 when he was 40. And now that he's 70, he looks 69. He's regenerating.
So that's my guest Chris O'Dowd in a scene from the Judd Apatow film, This Is 40. Since you've worked on several Judd Apatow projects and you were directed by him on this, what have you learned from him?
Quite a lot. I mean, he's incredibly smart, but also very, very well prepared. And the way that he'll do things is he talks to you during the take. So he'll have maybe five or six really funny lines up his sleeve if he feels like the one that he's written isn't working. And I guess what you learn from that is just don't be too precious about what you've written on the page yourself. You know, he just wants the funniest line. He doesn't want to make sure that the line that he wrote originally makes it to the cut.
So when you say he's feeding you lines, as he's talking to you as you're shooting, is he talking to you on a hidden earphone, or is he actually...
No, he's just shouting from a seat.
How come we're not hearing it on mic?
Well, he'll say whatever he's saying, and then I'll go, okay, cool, I'll try that.
So do you remember any lines from the scene we just heard that he told you to say as you were shooting?
I say the line there, you got to Benjamin Button that.
Yes. Yeah.
That very much sounds like a Judd line. And I'm sure the Keith Richards thing about him regenerating, he looked 70 when he was 40, definitely sounds... Because I can't remember it being in the script either. It's the same with the girls clip. I find it hard to remember what was in the script, what I came up with on the day, or what they came up with on the day. And I kind of like that about it. I never feel... When I do loads of improv in a scene and it doesn't make it, I'm never hurt by that because I can barely remember doing it afterwards.
Chris O'Dowd is nominated for a Tony for his starring performance in Of Mice and Men. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. What happened to works of art under the Nazis is still very much in the news. One piece of that history is the official Nazi response to modern art. They called it degenerate and put on a number of exhibits to demonstrate just how terrible it was. At a show at New York's Neue Galerie is the first major American exhibit since 1991 to deal with this subject. The show is called Degenerate Art, The Attack on Modern Art in Nazi Germany, 1937. Fresh Air's Lloyd Schwartz was there to see it.
One of the most unsettling rooms in an important art exhibit at New York's Neue Galerie is a room in which numerous empty frames are hanging, with guesses about which paintings might have been in them. The paintings themselves were all lost or destroyed by the Nazis. Encouraged by Hitler, most Nazis, Goebbels was the rare exception, considered everything but the most hidebound, traditionally realistic paintings and sculptures to be degenerate, a threat to the Aryan ideals of German culture. To bring this home, there was a series of exhibitions of shame designed to teach the German public to despise modernist art. This culminated in a major show in Munich in 1937, which later toured Germany and Austria. The public crowded to see it. That same summer in Munich, a counter-exhibit called The Great German Art Exhibition, including at least one work owned by Hitler, showed what the Nazis thought art should be. The Neue Galerie includes some 80 works from both of these landmark shows. The Nazis considered Jewish art collectors and dealers a major force behind the success of modernist art. and works depicting outsiders, Jews or Negroes, jazz was also considered degenerate, or anyone unhealthy, neurotic, or suffering, were also targets of their disapproval. So even though there were only six Jewish artists in the original exhibition, such non-Jews as the Bavarian Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, an innovative colorist, the Austrian master Oskar Kokoschka, and the fanciful Swiss artist Paul Klee were also the objects of attack. Their art was removed from museums, and thousands of so-called degenerate works were destroyed. Kirchner committed suicide in 1938. The strangest case may be that of the German expressionist Emil Nolde, a card-carrying Nazi who was a favorite of Goebbels. In spite of his high-placed connections, the Nazis turned against him, forbade him to show his work, and destroyed many of his paintings. This show has more than just the art. On display is Volume 1 of a chilling 482-page, neatly typed inventory of the works the Nazis confiscated from public museums and sold or destroyed. There are also information tags that indicate exactly where in the 1937 Munich exhibit each work was originally displayed. A 5-minute film clip by the American photographer Julian Bryan, who was working for the March of Time documentary series, shows the crowds of German men and women walking stone-faced past pieces of expressionistic, abstract, and Dada art. And there's that room with all the empty frames. Some remarkable work is here. Kirchner's A Group of Artists, his painting of his famous colleagues in the German proto-expressionist movement called Die Brücke, the Bridge, and his stunning winter landscape in moonlight. There's George Grosz's moving portrait of the writer Max Hermann Neisse, Paul Klee's marvelous twittering machine, Nolde's daring red-haired girl, and a spectacular Kandinsky painting of what looks like outer space circles. Max Beckmann's powerful biblical and political triptych Departure is hung on the same long wall as the airless and inertly realistic triptych of the four elements that Hitler owned and was prominently displayed in that officially sanctioned show of German art. In their arrangement, the curators here suggest the contrast between the way the degenerate art was chaotically jammed together and the more spacious display of the acceptable German works. So we get a more open view of the awful four elements and a sculpture called Decathlete, a life-size nude young man with an expression so dead you wouldn't want to be alone with him, clothed or unclothed, in a dark Munich alley. This is the first major exhibit to deal with the subject of degenerate art since 1991, when the L.A. County Museum mounted a recreation of the original Munich show. But this is the first time some of these Nazi favorites have been on display in this country. It's a powerful and disturbing show. And of all things, it's been so popular you might have to wait on a long line to get in. Just as people in Munich did in 1937 to see all that terribly degenerate modern art.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed the exhibit Degenerate Art, The Attack on Modern Art in Nazi Germany, 1937, at the Neue Galerie in New York. The show will be on view until September 1st. Coming up, John Powers talks about the films he saw at this year's Cannes Film Festival. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Cannes Film Festival, the most important international film festival, wrapped up last weekend. Fresh Air's critic-at-large John Powers, who's also the film critic for Vogue, was there. When he got back to the U.S., he sat down to talk to Terry about the festival winners and those that generated the biggest response, both positive and negative.
John, welcome back to Fresh Air, and thanks for taking some time to talk with us about Cannes. So let's start with the film that won the top prize. Tell us about it.
The winner of the Palme d'Or is a Turkish film by a director named Nuri Bilge Ceylan, who's well-known internationally, not so well-known in the United States. And his film is a Chekhovian study of a rich, famous actor who thinks himself a very enlightened man. However, he's not so enlightened in dealing with his tenants, who are largely poor and Islamic, nor is he so enlightened in dealing with his wife and his sister, both of whom know him so well they see through him. And the film is basically a portrait of modern Turkey seen through these people who all live in this posh hotel and their dealings with the people around them. It's filled with hilariously penetrating arguments between family members who know one another so well that every line they say to one another has many, many meanings. It's a tad too long at 3 hours and 15 minutes, but it's actually a very good film.
Would you have voted for it for the top prize?
The funny thing is, when I saw it, I wouldn't have. I was tired and jet-lagged and thought, this movie will never end. And yet, as the week went on, it stayed in my head very, very well. And I realized that, in fact, it probably was the best film in the competition.
Do you think it will open in the United States? Will we be able to see it?
I think you will be able to see it. I think, you know, partly because it won at Cannes, partly because Turkey's in the news, very interestingly, and partly because I think what often happens with European or non-American filmmakers is that gradually some sort of critical mass builds up and their films start being seen.
So what was the hottest ticket at Cannes?
Oh, hilariously, the hottest ticket at Cannes was for Ryan Gosling's directorial debut. I mean, it was very funny. I was at a lunch for another movie, a Hollywood movie, and at one point all the critics left and dashed off because we all had to go see the first feature by Ryan Gosling, which turned out to be not a good film. You realize that Ryan Gosling has seen a lot of movies and liked a lot of them. And so about every minute or two, you could identify some other famous director he was copying. So it started off a bit like Terrence Malick and Harmony Korine. A few minutes later, it turned into David Lynch. And then along the way, it turned into this guy, Nicholas Winding Refn, with whom Gosling has worked a lot. And it was this big, bloody, or fake bloody, apocalyptic, crazy melodrama with bright colors and darkness and bullies and people murdering rats and all sorts of other stuff that would seem powerful if you're putting it together and if you were David Lynch. But in the event, everyone thought was really, really bad. And so the discussion became, was this the worst film a director ever had premiered at Cannes?
Whoa. worst ever. But, you know, it's funny
ever,
because...
But it wasn't.
But you know, I think it was last year... that Ryan Gosling was in a film that, as I recall from what you said, was booed, the film Only God Forgives?
Yes, no, it was booed last year. It's a very peculiar thing because Ryan Gosling, and some of the older viewers may not realize this, is a huge international star and much beloved by women, so that he is a sex symbol and a star in the way that Brad Pitt was before Brad Pitt's movies really started being big movies. Ryan Gosling is kind of in those early stages of superstardom. So everything he does is invested with interest. So the longest line I saw at Cannes this year was for his film. The most excited fans were for his film. And the only problem was the film wasn't very good.
Too bad. I think he's a great actor. It's a shame.
Oh, no, he's a great actor. And I'm all for him. And in truth, you know, he was trying to make a genuinely great movie. And, you know, I respect that impulse more than somebody cautiously making a small little movie that's perfectly done for their first film.
So let's get to another prize winner at Cannes. And this is the second place, the Grand Jury Prize. It went to an Italian film called The Wonders by a director I have to say I've never heard of, Alice Rohrabacher. Tell us about her and the film.
Well, she is a young Italian director who most people have never heard of. She's only made one feature before that most people didn't see. But going into the festival, she was highly touted to win the Palme. Then the film showed, and people didn't love it enough. And it gradually got ignored along the way, and people were even kind of mean to it. You know, the critic in Variety said it didn't have enough weight to be in the competition at Cannes, which was completely wrong. And then, in the end, it won second prize. It's basically a family story about a young girl whose parents have more or less dropped out of society, moved from the city to the Italian countryside where they make money by making honey by taking care of bees. And the film is about her growing up, dealing with her family, but also about the transformation of the Italian countryside, which is becoming more and more about money and less about the old tradition. So it's a political film on the one hand and a personal film on the other. Extremely well made, not perfect, but a very impressive work for a young director in her 30s. And, you know, I was happy to see her get the prize.
Oh, good. So that's another one you think will come to the U.S.?
I think it will come to the U.S. I think one of the nice things when films win big prizes at Cannes is that a film that's good but doesn't sound commercial will suddenly take on a commercial life, and we'll get to see it in the U.S.
So two films tied for third place at Cannes, and that's called the Jury Prize. And one of them was a film that was apparently very divisive. Some people loved it, some people hated it. That one was called Mommy. And the other that tied was a Jean-Luc Godard film called Farewell to Language. You want to start with the one that caused so much disagreement?
Yes, you know, it's quite interesting because the two who tied, the young guy who made the film called Mommy, his name is Xavier Dolan, who's from Quebec, and he's 25 years old, and this is his fifth film. His first film played at Cannes when he was 20, and he's kind of an enfant terrible. And this film certainly lives up to that. It's the story of this over-the-top working-class mom whose son is an even more over-the-top and violent boy. And essentially, it's about their battles against each other, against society, against the social structure. What do you do with people who are completely out of control? It's broad. Some people think it's funny. It's extravagantly big in emotions. And when it played at Cannes, it gave people a jolt of energy that led some people, I think, to think it was better than it actually was. Coming out of it, people either thought it was brilliant or almost unwatchable. That was one of the third-place winners. The other one was this extremely arcane but beautiful film by Jean-Luc Godard, the great French master who at 84 is still probably the most radical filmmaker working anywhere. And it was a film about all the things that Godard likes to make movies about, which is to say the impossibility of communicating, the beauty of images, trying to connect to nature, how much fun it is to look at naked people. and what was so fascinating about this film, which I quite liked, was that it may be Godard's final film. And it's interesting that a person often thought to be the most intellectual and difficult filmmaker ever ended his film basically making the hero of this film and his work his dog. Because what he loves about dogs is that they fit into nature, they're neither conscious nor self-conscious, and they're capable of unconditional love. So after all the intellection, after all the brilliance, after all the difficulty, finally Godard is coming out on the side of being a dog.
You know what? You don't have to write dialogue for dogs.
You don't have to write dialogue for dogs because, as we learn from the film, dialogue doesn't really tell the truth. And in addition to all of that, the film is shot in 3D and partly uses 3D to mess with our heads because normally they try to make 3D look great. But Godard, being a radical, actually does certain moments where he superimposes two images, both in 3D, and when the images hit, your eyes start going in different directions and it all blurs and your eyes almost spin in your head. And you learn something about the nature of depth perception in 3D from watching his film because he actually plays with it in a way to show you how our vision works as well as just trying to make depth deeper in the film.
Am I going to get a headache?
If you watched a little longer, you would. But the first time he did it, people were so stunned and delighted that somebody was just messing with them with 3D that the crowd spontaneously broke into applause.
So let's get to another award at the Cannes Film Festival. And Best Director, that was won by Bennett Miller for his new film Foxcatcher. And see, he also made Capote.
And Moneyball.
Moneyball and a documentary called The Cruise.
Which is wonderful, which is quite wonderful.
So tell us about Foxcatcher.
Okay. Foxcatcher is based on a true story that somehow I never knew. It's the story about two Olympic wrestlers who get involved with the heir to the DuPont fortune, John E. DuPont, who decides he's going to set up a wrestling facility to help Olympic wrestlers, but it's partly his own vainglorious attempt to make himself impressive in his own eyes, in the eyes of the world, and in the eyes of his mother. And so you actually watch these more or less working-class wrestling types entering the world of the ultra-rich, and then very bad things happen, as they did happen in real life, where DuPont murders one of the brothers you know, for reasons that even now are not quite clear, although watching the film, you start to understand some of the reasons why.
It was a very big story in the Philadelphia and Delaware area, because that's where, as I recall, he was from, Delaware.
Well, and in fact, it's such a spectacularly interesting story. The film stars Channing Tatum, who one doesn't think of as being a very good actor, but who is very good here. It stars Mark Ruffalo, who one thinks of as being a good actor and who's excellent. And Steve Carell, wearing a prosthetic nose, playing the millionaire Johnny DuPont in a kind of creepy way that's unlike anything you've ever seen Steve Carell do before. All three are good. And watching the film, you understood why Bennett Miller won the Best Director, because he controls this complicated story. He never overemphasizes anything, and he gets really good performances from different levels of actors doing different kinds of things, which then reminds you that, you know, his first feature, Capote, won Philip Seymour Hoffman the Oscar, and that Moneyball got both Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill nominated for Oscars. And unlike many American directors, he doesn't hit everything hard. So it's a very subtle story, and he leaves you room to try to figure out yourself what's going on.
The Best Actress Award this year went to Julianne Moore for her performance in a David Cronenberg film called Maps to the Stars. And the film is an adaptation of a Bruce Wagner novel, and I was really surprised to hear this because Bruce Wagner writes usually satirical films based on life in Hollywood, and Cronenberg has been a kind of non-Hollywood guy. He's, well, not only because he's from Canada, but also because his sensibility is really not a Hollywood sensibility.
No, it's not. I mean,
let's just mention some of his films so people know who he is. Like History of Violence, Eastern Promises.
He made the film Dead Ringers and The Fly.
Yes.
And Naked Lunch. You know, he started off making pulpier, visceral horror movies and then gradually moved into more literary enterprises over the years. This particular one is, I guess, a poison pen letter to Hollywood in a way, in that it portrays Hollywood in all of its child-abusing, self-aggrandizing horror. Julianne Moore in this particular film plays a slightly crazy, narcissistic actress who's living in the shadow of her dead movie star mother. And she hires as her assistant a mysterious young woman played by Mia Wasikowska, who may or may not be some sort of avenging angel. And swirling around them is the fake guru therapist played by John Cusack and the handsome limo driver played by Robert Pattinson of Twilight fame. And the film is a portrait of that kind of Hollywood, but told with the kind of coldness and detachment, in a way, that Cronenberg often brings to things. So it's a very weird, very nastily funny film. And Julianne Moore plays, as she often does, an out-of-control person. But she does it hilariously well. Going into the film, I knew she was playing that role. And I thought, good heavens, I don't want to have to see Julianne Moore playing a nutty middle-aged woman. I don't think I can handle it. But in fact,
why not?
She nailed the role. Because she's been doing it for 20 years.
Oh.
And because she's a good actress and is fearless, and because Hollywood, once you do something, they want you to do it over and over again, has been playing some version of the cracking up woman for 20 years. And because the last time I'd seen her was in the film Don John, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt film, where she played a sensible woman, and she was so wonderful, I thought, thank heaven she gets to go back to being just a normal human being rather than a nut job. Here she plays a nut job, but she's so great that I wasn't surprised she won the prize.
So, John, how would you sum up this year's Cannes Film Festival? Was it a good festival, lots of good films?
It was a festival with lots of good films, but not a lot of great, you know, knock-you-out films. It's one of the peculiarities of the film festival biz, I guess, is that when you fly halfway around the world, you want to be knocked out. And so if a film's merely good, somehow you're disappointed. So that although I probably saw, you know, 10 or 12 films that if in the normal state of my life I'd driven to a screening to see, I would have been delighted that I saw them. Because I was jet-lagged and flown halfway around the world, I then thought, this isn't quite good enough. You know, and what often happens with these films is that I then see them later back in Los Angeles. And I think, boy, was that a good film. And I think, why was I so negative about it when I saw it at Cannes? And the answer was, when you fly to Cannes, you're expecting masterpieces. And so you're disappointed by mere excellence.
And you're also seeing one film after another after another. It's a very unnatural way to see a movie.
Yes, you know, no normal human being would see a film at 8:30, at 11, at 1, wait in line for half an hour for a 3.25-hour Turkish film, and dash off and go to another film. And if they did it, they wouldn't expect to think, oh, I'm going to be having a good time at all of these. Whereas when you're at Cannes, you're going there and you think you're being rigorous and critical and intelligent. And what's happening is you're getting exhausted and you're getting tired of being in line. You're getting tired of talking to people the whole time. And you're getting tired of sitting, you know. And in the midst of all of that, you then have people like myself making judgments that they then later think aren't true.
You know, in following your blog posts about the festival, it sounds like there was a lot of movies this year with animals, including Jean-Luc Godard's new film, and also lots of scenes of brutality towards animals. Any pattern that's emerging here?
When you watch animals brutalized on film, I find it almost unbearable. And I think probably most people do. I think that one reason why this year, and increasingly you're seeing abuse of animals in film, is that it's a way of getting pure emotion out of audiences. That it's a way of reaching audiences who are so jaded and have seen so many people murdered on screen that they don't care. But somehow if you actually see a cow shot down or a rabbit or in particular a dog, that plunges a dagger into your heart in a way that so many of the other things don't, because maybe because you've seen them so much or because cinema's gotten so violent toward people, that now you almost don't reach people. A couple of years ago, there was a great boom in films about dead children and missing children. And that's now been replaced by terrible things happening to animals, which is a very depressing and discouraging thing to watch. You know, I mean, for several days in a row, I watched some animal die awfully on screen. You know, so it was a great relief by the time you got to the Jean-Luc Godard film, where he was loving his dog. And the film by Asia Argento, the once scandalous Italian actress, who made a film about her childhood where basically her great friend and guardian angel was her cat, Dak, a big, wonderful black cat that won the Palme de Whiskers, which one of the critics gives every year for the best cat performance.
John Powers is Fresh Air's critic at large and the film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.